Well, it's a real pleasure to have with us Helena. She came up yesterday evening from Wales, and she very sacrificially dragged loads and loads of books. So they're out there. So do feel free at the break to look and to ask questions of Helena about them and to make payment, we trust. Helena has worked an awful lot with eating disorders, and her ministry has really spanned the world, even as far away as South Africa. And she has written copiously about eating disorders and other subjects as well. So we're really privileged to have her this morning. Helena's own experience meant that at the age of 19, her first book, Puppet on a String, was published. But since then, there are many titles like Snakes and Ladders, A Way Out of Despair, such ones as that. Also, Helena belongs to the Society of Authors, the Society of Women Writers and Journalists, and the Association of Christian Writers as professional bodies. And she also works under the auspices of Nicolaston House, which is an organization that reaches out in different areas, including to eating disorders. So before Helena comes to speak, I'm going to pray. So let's just look to God for this. Lord, we really do thank you that in you we have the friend who sticks closer than a brother. And we're so glad to be here this morning looking at what is a tender subject and in some ways a painful subject. And we just pray in every way that you will help us this morning, helping Helena and each of us also who are participating, that everyone will walk away with a little bit more of you and helped further in this field. We do thank you and praise you, Lord. Amen. Okay, over to Helena.
It sounds as if Genevieve knows more about me than I know about myself, so that's lovely. It's a real pleasure to be here, and just to share this time with you, and I hope that by the end of this morning you'll have gone away with a little bit more information about eating disorders, whether that's to apply to yourself or to somebody that you're coming alongside, or just general knowledge. As Genevieve said, my whole background to working in this area is that I was myself a sufferer of anorexia during my teens and recovered, and in the process of recovery wrote down what was going on. Never intended for publication, but somebody got hold of it in the press and said, you know, have you not thought about getting this published? And I was so naive at the time, still being a teenager, that I thought that if you write a book, okay, maybe it gets published. It didn't occur to me that people read it. I know it sounds a bit crazy, but... And if people read it, it impacts their life. And if it impacts their life and they're struggling, they want an answer. And I was inundated by requests from people to get out of this very difficult situation, be it anorexia, bulimia, compulsive eating, or many other addictions. And that's really how I was, shall I say, thrown into the ministry, but planned by God. And that's the difference, that he knew from the beginning that was going to be part of my life work. So that's my work in a nutshell. I could say a lot more, but we're very restricted on time. If you would like further information, just I'll say at the beginning, because I'll probably forget by the end of the day, I have some little brochures of the work of Nicolaston House in Wales. Eating disorders is one part. It's an absolutely stunning setting. You can come for a holiday, you can come for a walking week, a painting break, help for eating disorders, prayer ministry, all sorts of different things. So there are plenty of these for more than one if you would like them. Also on the side, some little slips of paper, a reply slip it says, and that is if you want to sign up for an email newsletter from me, which is there to support people who are going through struggles, but also to get updated on the work, particularly that I'm involved in. So that's on the side. And just to reiterate what Genevieve said is please buy some books, because they were really heavy dragging them across London. And I would be delighted to have a very light suitcase on the way home. Puppet on a String is my own story that I wrote when I was younger, shall I say. And Snakes and Ladders is the follow-up to that. If you want to purchase both books, then you can have £5 off that. Beyond Chaotic Eating and others. So if you need any explanations, this is the newest one, Finding Freedom, all about surrender, which Genevieve and I were talking about last night. So on to eating disorders. If you're wondering why I've got funny hair, I've been in Barbados, by the way. Shame, isn't it? Real shame. I didn't have time to take it out, so I thought I'd leave it in and give you all a laugh. I'm just going to ask you a few things. Did you know, for instance, did you know that eating disorders have the highest death rate amongst psychiatric illnesses? Did you know that between 10 and 20% of adult sufferers are actually male? And on the increase, I believe, probably. Did you know that children as young as 5 suffer from anorexia? Did you know that 30% of children with eating disorders are boys? That 20 years ago, models weighed 8% less than the average woman. Now they weigh 23% less. That the dieting industry is worth $33 billion in the US alone. That 16% of men and 17% of women in the UK are classified as obese. That some people suffer from eating disorders for more than half their adult lives. Some for all their adult lives. That over the past 30 years, reported cases of anorexia have doubled every decade. That it's estimated that almost 50,000 people in the UK every year consult their doctor about anorexia. That a recent BMA report stated that every GP in the country now treats 2 patients with anorexia and 18 with bulimia. Did you know that one anorexic weighed just over 3 stone? And that one compulsive eater weighed 114 stone. Many people with eating disorders have suffered a major emotional trauma prior to their eating disorder. And that 1/3 of people with eating disorders who seek therapy say that they have been sexually abused. Did you know that many doctors, or most doctors and therapists, believe that a person cannot fully recover from an eating disorder? And that eating disorders are not actually about food and weight. Those are just a few facts that you may or you may not have known. Eating disorders is prevalent, is on the increase. It's impacts every person in this room. It impacts probably most people in this society, in that we all probably know somebody who is suffering or know somebody who knows somebody. It's in the press. It's around us and surrounding us all the time. It's more understood now than it was certainly when I was suffering over 20 years ago. But there are still many misconceptions and misunderstandings, a lot of fears for sufferers as to, you know, whether they can expose that that's what their problem is. What are people going to think if I do? Am I going to be seen differently? So many different things that are actually going on. Different eating disorders. No two eating disorders are exactly the same. There's anorexia, where people will cut back on what they're eating, they will lose weight, women will stop menstruating. There will be an obsession and a distorted body image. There's bulimia, where people will overeat and then vomit or exercise, take laxatives. Again, an obsession often with body weight and image. And compulsive eating, where people, similar to bulimia, but then don't often compensate in any way. So there'll be this insatiable hunger, this need to eat, this drivenness. And they are, in effect, addictions. So there is a crossover with all sorts of other addictions, drug, alcohol, self-harm, different ways of actually handling situations. They are also, can be summed up by saying that they are coping mechanisms. You have pretty comprehensive notes there, which I'm not going to get through all of today, but I thought it would still be nice for you to take the information away. And you see that Marilyn Lawrence once said that anorexia is not the problem, but the solution. And really, if there are two things that I encourage people to understand, it is that an eating disorder is not actually the problem, but the solution to a whole load of problems. So what is the problem? The other thing that I really want people to understand, and we'll address this after the coffee break, is that it is possible to recover, fully recover, and not go back into those patterns. And I'd really like you to leave today with that message in your heart, that you can make a full recovery and never go back into those patterns again. So be encouraged. So I'm not going to actually go over the details of what makes up an eating disorder, what an eating disorder looks like, or the medical statistics, and because we haven't got time for that. I think we all know roughly what anorexia is. We all know roughly what bulimia and compulsive eating are. What I want to concentrate on this morning is why. What's actually going on underneath? Why do people go to those extremes? Why would a young woman or a young man or an older person go to the extreme of starving themselves to the point of emaciation? Why would they look in the mirror and not be able to see what they look like? Why would somebody know that they're physically full and yet go on eating and eating and eating and eating until they literally feel that they could split? What is it that is driving them? You know, why isn't logic overriding? Why can't they get out? Why can't they just snap out of these situations? As I said, the first thing to understand is that it's not actually the problem, and that's where people go wrong. They often think, you know, here's somebody with an eating disorder, and I need to help them to get out of that eating disorder. True. But the way I've explained it in one of my later books, Insight into Eating Disorders, is it's a little bit like an iceberg. 9/10 of an iceberg is below the water. When you look at an eating disorder, what you look at, other people particularly, is they're looking at the iceberg, the what you see above the water surface. And that is the behaviour of the person. That's the eating, the not eating, the hiding food, the being sick, the putting on weight, the losing weight, the self-harm. That's what's seen. But actually 9/10 of the iceberg, the problematic part of the iceberg, is below the water surface. And unless that is dealt with, then the iceberg is still going to sit there. It's still going to be obvious. And so often what happens with an eating disorder is that if only the behavioural aspect of the eating disorder is dealt with and not below the water surface, which we're going to look at, then the eating pattern, the behavioural pattern, may go, but it will re-emerge in another way. So it may think, great, somebody's recovered from anorexia, but now they've got bulimia. Somebody's recovered from anorexia, but actually now they're using relationships or drugs or alcohol or self-harm. And when I talk about eating disorders, I talk about recovery, I'm actually talking about a full, lasting recovery, in which case you need to actually look at what's going on underneath. And that isn't recovery from something that then re-emerges as something else, you know, a few months or a year down the line. So, as I said, everybody's case with the situation with an eating disorder is slightly different. My situation with anorexia would not be identical to somebody else's situation with anorexia. It's helpful to have a label, but it's unhelpful to have a label too, because we are all slightly different. But what I've found in my own life and in working with people is that there are common themes flowing through eating disorders. So although this is not necessarily everything that I'm going to say applies to every person, you will find that there is a common theme. So if we look first of all just at anorexia, why would somebody go to those extremes? Well, partly it is the type of person, the background they come from, the things that they have encountered. But actually, it becomes a protection against emotion. It becomes a protection against normally pain and anger. And if somebody doesn't know what to do with those emotions, then they do something else. And the protection against pain, the pain could be anything. In my situation, I was actually born blind. I'm still registered partially sighted. So when I went to school, I didn't know how to mix and relate. I couldn't see things. I couldn't take things down off the board, so I had to pretend that I knew what I was doing, and I didn't. I was very severely bullied. I was sexually abused. All sorts of difficult situations in my early and later childhood and early adulthood. And for me, anorexia became a protection against that pain. For somebody else, it may not be as complex as that. There may not be severe trauma. But life itself for some people is painful. Just the mere existence, the how to communicate, achievement. And when things go wrong, the anorexic starves herself. It's not like a loss of appetite. It's actually a power over appetite. And again, that's where people often go wrong. You know, here's a young person, let's help them to eat. Actually, the whole point of anorexia is not to eat. The whole point is to take power over the appetite and to control it. And those whole feelings, this whole concentration on food and weight and how much I weigh, distracts the person from what's going on in their head, in their emotions, in their interacting. You see, I believe that when a person has an eating disorder, be it anorexia or bulimia or compulsive eating, the eating disorder is not just in the area of eating, it's actually in the whole of that person's life. So I sometimes do a little demo, but with a bar of chocolate or a biscuit. And if I was to hand it to an anorexic, the response would be no. But you see, it isn't just no to food. It's no. It's no, I can't take things in. I don't know if you've ever met somebody who's chronically anorexic, who there's just this whole sort of blankness about them sometimes. Can't feel loved. Can't receive. You see, it's not just taking in nutrition, it's actually taking in. And it's those areas that need to be addressed, because otherwise a person will physically recover but still be an anorexic or bulimic in their lifestyle, their mentality, their interactions. So the anorexic is very often trying to protect dull emotion, get rid of what's going on underneath through the whole relationship with food and starvation. Often the person doesn't have much understanding about how to handle things like anger and conflict. One of the things that we do in working with people when they come on courses is actually developing life skills. It's no good just being able to eat the right foods, being able to put on the right weight, if then you have no idea how to relate and communicate. You have no idea how to handle anger and conflict. Because it would be too easy and too tempting to slide back into these addictive patterns if the life skills to live in this world don't exist. And I believe very strongly that a part of the reason behind eating disorders is a lack of life skills. Also for the anorexic, there is a struggle over or a loss of a sense of identity. Same can be said for so many different situations. And so the person takes on this anorexic identity. At least I know who I am now. You know, it defines what I like and don't like. Very often the person who develops anorexia is somebody who struggles to accept herself, struggles to know where she fits in relation in life, in relation to other people. And, you know, that loss of identity, again, it could have occurred for all sorts of different reasons. I've seen many different reasons. Control within the family, very strict upbringing, a twin, not a twin, a middle child, an older child, a younger child, peer pressure, bullying, being on the outside. Just this general sense of loss of identity, which again is why so many teenagers begin to suffer with eating disorders. That time in life when you're really questioning, who am I? Where am I going? Do people like me? Do they love me? What is love? I don't know. So I identify with this way of being. And one way of being is the whole anorexic way of being. Very hard to then break out of that identity and mentality. And the desire to recover is there for some people. But the fear is huge. who am I going to be without this? And very often when you talk to people, they'll say, I do want to get better, but I don't know who I'm going to be if I'm not anorexic or I'm not bulimic. And one of the things that we work on very strongly is actually developing that sense of identity, that core identity. As a Christian, for me, that would be my core identity as a child of God, and then my individuality as well. And I personally believe that that must be worked on and strengthened in order for somebody to recover. Because if you take away the anorexia or the bulimia, if you just strip it away and you're left with this void, it's very easy for the person to then fill it with something else. So actually working on those issues is essential, but we'll come back to that after the break. So anorexia creates a form of identity, and it gives a stronger sense of being, of the person being in charge of her own life, which is preferable to it being managed by other people. And very often you will find that there are control issues around anorexia, and there becomes a need within that person's life to take control. And anorexia or any addiction is a good form, not a good form in one way, but in the person's mind is a good form of being in control. But, you know, that lack of individuality leads to the person being over-submissive very often, non-assertive, difficulty making decisions. If you don't know who you are, it's very difficult to know how to make choices. You know, if I don't know who I am, I don't know what I like and I don't like. What shall I wear? What choice shall I make? What's right and what's wrong? You know, these are really big, key issues for the person who's going through something like anorexia. It is easier to simply concentrate on what I'll eat, what I won't eat, how much I weigh, whether it's bird's-eye peas or not bird's-eye peas. And, you know, although the person who becomes anorexic wants to conform to society, wants to conform to her family, wants to conform to whatever, she's actually in a battle. And you've only got to look at the conflict that's going on to at a practical level to see the battle that's going on at an emotional level. If you look at, here is a person, normally above average intelligence, you know, good looking, creative, capable. Here is a person who is conveying to the world by refusing food, conveying, you know, I'm in control, I'm strong. And yet, by the weight loss, the fragility, the childlikeness is actually conveying to the world, I can't cope. And there is this huge battle going on in the mind, this being pulled in two directions. And you see this also very much with bulimia, this pulled in two totally different directions. And having to try and pull those two together to create one whole person, rather than this split that has occurred. For the anorexic, there's also big issues around perfection and control. And probably for most people, to underline that word control would be very relevant. The anorexic has a strong desire to do away with failure and to attain purity. And anything which falls below the person's standard is considered as failure. And this isn't just failure as in sort of academic failure, it's actually just the whole sense of failure as a person. Perfection is nearly always an issue with anorexia, not always, but very often. But again, it's not just perfection as in wanting to achieve a certain standard, it's this sense that I am not okay, and so I must eradicate this not okayness about me. And when the person is standing in front of a mirror and is emaciated but sees flesh and fat, that actually a lot of that is about wanting to eradicate this not okayness. Flesh equals giving in, weakness. And there's this sense of, I need to get rid of this weakness within me. I need to get rid of this thing that has basically led me to bad places in life. For some people, that's associated with trauma and abuse. And if I can purify myself and get rid of flesh equaling that which isn't nice, i.e. the abuse. And attached to that often becomes, you know, other forms of destruction, getting in touch with emotion, releasing emotion, getting rid of sense of badness through things like self-harm, pushing, extreme ritualistic behaviour, obsessive-compulsive behaviour. So often misunderstood, because actually it's what's going on deep down inside the person. What is the behaviour saying? I always say an eating disorder is like a language. What is the language? What is the person communicating about themselves? What is the person communicating about their family, about their past? What are they communicating about study and education, the world, life, adulthood, ability to relate to people? If you can begin to look at it as a language, it's really helpful. And just ask yourself that question, well, what is not being said that needs to be said? It's being said through the body. It's being said through behaviour. And rather than just looking at the behaviour and how can we change the behaviour, how can we control the behaviour, but what is actually being said through the behaviour? So the person, however low they are in weight, you know, it's never low enough, because there is this sense of, I've got to get rid of this nastiness inside. And so the anorexic patterns, the cutting back on the eating, the starving, the exercising, gives a sense of power in a life that has known powerlessness. In what way has it known powerlessness? For me, that was bullying, abuse, control. For somebody else, it might be something else. But in what way has that person known powerlessness? Why has it become so necessary to suddenly take power? People take power through drink. People take power through drugs. It reaches a point where the person never wants to get to that stage of powerlessness again. They have to find some way to take control themselves. And that, again, is the battle for recovery. Because in the mind of the person who is struggling, there is this, if this thing is taken away from me, whatever it is, I will be out of control. And other things and other people will control me. And this is where I really believe that a Christian answer is so crucial to eating disorders. Because it's not about, you know, when you get to that point where you can lay down your life and know that God is walking with you, and that basically you don't have to take control in that way. I don't know how I would have recovered had it not been for God. Not saying that Christians, you know, we're the only ones who have the answer. But I do believe the recovery is different. I don't know that I would be standing here. I don't even know that I would be alive had I not made that commitment and not taken that route. But that's another whole story. You have to read the book for that one. Okay. So what about the other eating disorders? What about bulimia and compulsive eating? So some of what I've said about anorexia is relevant for those conditions as well. Some people don't fall neatly into anorexia or bulimia or compulsive eating. I personally believe that there are thousands, millions of people, particularly women, but not exclusively, out there with eating issues who would never get diagnosed as having an eating disorder. But they still got an issue around food. Probably the majority of women have got an issue around food and body image, and that's sad. You know, that's sad. That's not the way it was intended. Bulimia is similar, except the taking in of food and the getting rid of food is actually symbolising a different place that the person is in. This person who develops bulimia is often more able to take in relationship, more able to communicate, more able to relate, but can't hold on to it. And so pushes it away. And again, you would see this in the eating pattern, taking in food, getting rid of food. But that is symbolised, carried out in relationship, in emotions, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, I believe that a person has an eating disorder in all of those areas. So the bulimic is often somebody who is in conflict, but she presents herself as someone, or him, as someone who is strong and their own person. And yet, what's inside is very different. Very often there is an emotional neediness and there is a hunger. And I believe this is an emotional and a spiritual hunger very often. There is a hunger inside. Yet what is being presented on the outside is not what is going on in the inside. And there is this conflict between this copa and this non-copa. Which is why people with bulimia can carry on that pattern for many years without anybody knowing. Take John Prescott's recent admission. Was it 20 years he said that he had been struggling and suffering with this? Lots of other well-known people who have admitted, Elton John, and then obviously there was Princess Diana before. I remember a lady coming up at the end of a seminar I gave in Guernsey many years ago saying, you know, I've had bulimia, I'm married, and I've had bulimia for 10 years within that marriage and my husband doesn't know. And there is conflict going on inside her at that time. There was a split very often between the part which is in control and the part which is dependent. And because of this need to actually hide and because of the shame around the non-coping part, we've all got a non-coping part, because of the shame about that, the person is hiding and carrying out these patterns. It's often very much about relating. I think all eating disorders, you know, they are relational conditions. They're not just body image conditions. They are actually relational conditions. They're conditions around the feelings that we have to do with other people. And if we can resolve those and learn to cope in life, then there becomes little need to carry out the eating patterns. By consuming enormous amounts of food, the bulimic is saying, I'm desperately needy. Then by vomiting it out, she's actually saying, I reject it all. I'm actually terrified of having my needs met. This real sort of push-pull. Searching for a perfect love. Searching for, as is the case with lots of different situations, searching for perhaps something that she didn't or he didn't get in childhood. Unmet childhood needs, not knowing how to relate now because those foundational needs were not met. And I believe very strongly in this, in the effects of early childhood on things like eating disorders later on in life. Foundational needs that weren't met, and so this hunger, this craving, this looking for those needs to be met in some way. And seeking out avenues that become destructive. Again, this is where alcohol and drugs and self-harm often come in. And overeating and vomiting often fills up that empty space. And as people recover, it's all, if I'm not binging and vomiting, what do people spend their time on? What do people think about? That's one of the things that people with eating disorders say is, what do, inverted commas, normal, if you have normal people, I don't know, what do normal people think about if they don't think about food? And, it's quite a big question, isn't it? What do, and I think, I don't know, what do I think about? I probably think about how to get to Cambridge on the train, you know, things like that. But with an eating disorder, it is so life-consuming. It is life-controlling. It dictates who you spend your time with, what you do, where you go, when you go. It's there initially to help a person cope with life, but in the end, it takes over their life. And that's the point at which somebody knows that they need help. Because every decision that's being made is being made in the light of the eating disorder. So it's also about negative feelings. We're not really brought up often, particularly in this society, very well with what to do with negative feelings. Assertiveness, saying no, conflict, anger, jealousy, particularly as Christians, then you become a Christian and it's made even worse because you think, well, now I'm definitely not meant to have those things. A lot of people say, you're not even a Christian with an eating disorder? I say, yes. Because often, actually, Christianity compounds, not Christianity itself, but the way we as Christians have treated other people often compounds these problems. And the misunderstandings that, you know, surround the way we are to live as Christians. So people grow up with this, I don't know what to do with these. And they don't do them. They don't talk what they need to say. They don't speak it out. They don't communicate. They don't deal with the anger. They don't deal with the past. Then there are belief structures, you know, within the church that says, if you come to the cross, your past is dealt with. Yes, it is. But there's the practical outworking. There's the therapeutic input, whether that's just within yourself or, you know, the working it out. Theologically, yes, your past is dealt with at the cross. But that doesn't necessarily take away the mindset at that moment, the feelings. And then this person is left. Well, now I feel even worse because I've become a Christian and people are telling me it's supposed to be behind me. If only it was so simple. And so for me, helping people with eating disorders, there's a whole re-educating people. Theologically, yes, but also emotionally, relationally, life skills-wise. A whole re-education. If I could take the ideal situation to help somebody, it would be good nutritional input, it would be good relational, good role models, it would be good spiritual input, teaching, equipping, and we'll go into that a little bit after the coffee break. But those are the things that are necessary because people don't know what to do with difficult situations in life. And so getting into an addictive pattern like binging and vomiting is very easy. Then you get a media or, you know, that is pushing body image, is saying that you feel better at a certain weight. You get an influence of, you open magazines, particularly women's magazines, and you look at models who are not the average person. You have to be a certain height and a certain build to be a model. But you open the magazine and you see these images of perfection. And actually, most of us do not match up to those images of perfection. And so you have somebody who has already got a weakened sense of identity and self-worth, who has already got a mindset that says, you know, something's wrong with me, I'm not good enough. And depending on the personality, the circumstances, and all sorts of other things, that person will then be pushed into some sort of addictive pattern. And when I say addictive, that is exactly what it is. The more you go down that route, the more addictive that becomes. So starting down the route of something like anorexia or bulimia or overeating seems quite straightforward. But it becomes addictive because the patterns become ingrained. It's a bit like if you're on a certain track and you're trudging through the woods and you're knocking down the nettles and the brambles, and if you keep walking that, you are, in the end, you have a really good path. And every day you can walk that path very simply. If you're going to move paths, you've got to start the whole process of hacking down again. So it's too easy to stay on that path. And that's what it's like with an addiction. It's too comfortable, it's too easy to stay on that path. Then spiritually, I also believe things begin to happen to keep people in addictions. We may all be coming from different places on this, but you know, I believe that strongholds start to get built up, mindsets, and the enemy would have people stay on that path. Because that path also has to, there is a blockage between the individual and God on that path. Because the mindset is just focused on the behaviour. So, it becomes too easy to actually stay there. So for the bulimic, the pattern becomes very addictive. And vomiting actually comes to the point where the person doesn't even have to try. It just happens automatically. The compulsive eater is a very similar situation to the bulimic, except very often you'll also find that there is a deep hunger inside. Again, an emotional and, I believe, a spiritual hunger, and a searching, and a need to fill, and nearly a need to actually fill the void that is going on inside. So the person is not just hungry for food, but she's hungry, or he's hungry, for anything that they are basically deprived of. Love, affection, communication, worth, value. And food helps to mask problems and to push down unwanted emotions. And so compulsive eating can be used to avoid the fact that the person's life is disappointing. And Genevieve and I were talking about disappointment a bit last night. But, you know, disappointment is a big area in eating disorders as well. I think particularly once you get people who are developing an eating disorder at a slightly older age, this real sense of disappointment with life. Food's used to comfort the person when they hurt, to hide vulnerability, to flee handling responsibility. It's eaten to ease frustration and tension, to disguise insecurity. And because it's an addiction, you know, food gets eaten in the end in response to anything and everything. So any kind of addiction, it's like, it becomes an excuse, so it's time to celebrate, so I'll eat. I'm depressed, so I'll eat. You know, the response becomes the same. And you say the same with anorexia. It's like, well, I've taken an exam, I'm nervous, so I can't eat. I'm doing this, so I can't eat. That's the addictive side of it. That becomes an excuse to carry out the actual pattern. So eating actually creates a form of relief from situations. It creates a form of relief from negative feelings. And this is both psychological and also physiological. Psychologically, you know, you see young children, they hurt or they fall over. You give them, what, a lettuce leaf? No, I don't think so. You give them sweets or an ice cream or something. You know, don't worry, mate, have this. And we actually psychologically build up that whole image that, you know, when I'm hurting, sweet food's good. And it does something. But also, physiologically, there is a chemical release in the brain. So when we eat, endorphins are released, and that creates a feeling of being relaxed. Physical exercise and other things also release endorphins. But it creates that feeling of being relaxed. I only have to look at my dog, you know, I feed him, woof, 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 yum, and then crash, he's out. And that actually happens to us. You know, don't eat a big meal at lunchtime or you won't hear the lecture in the afternoon. You know, that you're always saying that to students and things. So it's a physical thing that goes on in the brain. And did you know that the combination of coffee and chocolate creates some of the same releases in the brain of being in love? So those of us who are single, we're allowed to have coffee and chocolate. Okay. If you're married, you're lucky. That's all I can say. There you go. But, you know, there are actually, to eating disorders, there is a physiological component. Some people who binge actually have a food intolerance. They can't tolerate things like perhaps flour or sugar, and very often they crave the things that they're intolerant of. So don't dismiss the physical side of an eating disorder. Equally, don't dismiss the emotional or the spiritual side. So often people who have compulsive eating actually have issues going on underneath that are unresolved, but they can keep this happy appearance on the outside because they can keep the negative emotions down through the use of the food, through the use of alcohol. It does the same thing. But inside, there is a sense of emptiness. Now, there's obviously a lot more that I could go through on that, but what I thought we've got, I think it's, are we having coffee break at 11? Yeah. So if, after the coffee break, I'm going to look a little bit about emotional hunger and trauma, and then the actual recovery process, what's needed in order to make a recovery from an eating disorder, and, you know, how and what's involved in a person coming through to full recovery. But we've got 5 minutes, so just in terms of the actual content of what lies on underneath an eating disorder, is there anything that anybody would like me to address? Any questions that you'd like to ask? Anything I've said that didn't make sense? Yes.
This is kind of a technical question, really. In bulimia, is the vomiting voluntary, like putting
yes.
down the throat, or
yes.
just involuntary, like when you've got tummy bug?
Self-induced vomiting, normally by putting fingers down your throat. But when a person has been bulimic for a long time, they only have to actually literally move a stomach muscle in order to make it happen. But it is still a choice to carry it out. Yeah. And the thing also is the body gets used to that way, you see. I mean, like with somebody who's not eating, the stomach is a muscle and it shrinks. The body gets used to a certain thing. With bulimia, the body gets used to eating and then getting rid of the food. Those who are overeating, the body is used to that larger amount of food, or they're used to grazing throughout the day. So when you actually recover, there's an awful lot to address in the whole recovery process. And it's complex because, unlike chemical addiction, where you can actually cut that out, you can't cut food out. You know? So it is quite hard. Yes, somebody there. Yes. 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 That's right. Absolutely. It's what I call payoffs. That, you know, people do tend to have a payoff to holding on to whatever it is. I mean, it may be a very traumatic situation, but yes. There's one side of your brain that says, I want to be free of this and I want to recover from it. Another side, well, I don't know what life will be like if I don't, or I don't want to grow up, or, you know, whatever it is. So that's one of the first things that we do in helping people, is actually look at the pros and cons, both of having an eating disorder and holding on to and letting go of, you know, whatever it is going on underneath. And in my mind, it's quite normal in the whole recovery process to be in this place initially, where you're juggling this wanting and not wanting. And that I would expect. But there has to come a point, as difficult as it is, there has to come a point at which people begin to move over to being willing. Otherwise, the person won't recover. You will invest time and time and time and time in, but they won't actually move forward. So there does have to come a point where that decision is made. But it's not easy, you know. It sounds so easy, isn't it? It sounds, if somebody's got a physical illness, you think, well, I'd give anything just to get better. It's very complex, the whole process. Yes.
Can I just ask, is there one of your books that would be particularly good to give to a person who's now 23, who's been anorexic for 10 years,
the hurdle
as opposed to other people
to understand? Probably Beyond Catholic Eating. Yes. Because that gives a lot of insight into different things that she can work through. And the things in the second half of it, which goes through the recovery process, because eating these things that I'm talking about, they're not exclusively for eating disorders. So even if somebody is partly recovered, fully recovered, or they've been through other things and have certain behavioural patterns that perhaps are not eating disorders, they'll still be able to relate to the recovery process. A lot of, you know, general counselling tools and things in there. All right. Any other questions before we have coffee? Yes. 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 Fine. Yes. I think some of the teaching in the church, yes, it can reinforce low self-esteem. Equally, it can go the other way and give a sort of plastic self-esteem, if you know what I mean. So, you know, a plaster on top of a wound when you then don't actually address the wound sufficiently. And yes, there's so much within the teaching. And again, also, if it's taken out of context or misunderstood, or when you also know that when somebody with an eating disorder, because their mindset is very black and white, and particularly somebody who is going down in weight or in starvation, the thinking, the brain is affected, and thinking is very, very black and white. So even teaching that would, for somebody else, might have been set in context and been helpful for that individual actually becomes unhelpful because of their black and white thinking that is like a filter that comes in between them and the teaching that they're receiving. So often the way it is presented to somebody with a situation like an eating disorder needs to be different to perhaps the average or the normal, whatever that is again, person. But yes, you're right. Yeah, I'll see if I can pick up on that a bit. Yes. Yeah. Well, it does sometimes, because for some people, not eating or anorexia is a slow form of suicide. It's not for everybody. You know, there are different categories of anorexia, but for some people, there is a passive death wish, and so there isn't the ability or whatever is required to actually carry out the act of suicide. But there is a passive death wish, and so it is a passive suicide, basically. But you can't apply that to every anorexic. I've actually noticed quite a distinct... Well, I think there are a number of different types of anorexia, but I've noticed two distinct types. One which is very much more focused around body image, fear of gaining weight. Maybe there isn't any particularly major trauma, but they get into the whole anorexic mindset. Then there is what I call much more trauma-based anorexia, where it is very much specifically a coping mechanism to things that have gone on, or, you know, a suicide wish.